Now then, Luke chapter 15. I want to start with a question. And the question is, when was the last time you had a celebration? And what made you celebrate? Jonathan?
Going to Kevin Lee.
Going to Kevin Lee. Pretty good. And what made you celebrate?
Because we've not been there for ages.
Good. Eva?
That it was my birthday.
It's your birthday. That's a good thing. And why do we celebrate that? Yeah, remembering your life when you were born. Anything else? Or anything from the big children at the back? When was the last time you celebrated? No one. Room of grumpy people. No one celebrates here, apparently. Well, here's a question for you. What makes God celebrate? Might not have ever thought of that question before. Jonathan, got an idea?
When people follow him.
When people follow him? Very good. Eva?
When people repent.
When people repent. Fantastic. Nathan?
When people come to him.
When people come to him. Very good. Now, if you were listening very carefully to the reading that Josh gave before, then you will already know the answer. Now, when we celebrate, we like people to celebrate with us. We have joy in something, and we want them to have joy in the same thing that we have joy in. And that's the same with God. The thing that God celebrates in, he wants us to have joy in that same thing too. So let's find out exactly what that thing is. Luke chapter 15. Now, who is Jesus talking to when he says this parable? Sam?
The Pharisees.
Mm-hmm, Pharisees, that's one group of people. Nathan?
Tax collectors.
Tax collectors, yeah. So there's the tax collectors and the sinners, they're the bad people. And the Pharisees and the scribes, they're the good people. Now, verse 1 says, the tax collectors and the sinners were all drawing near to him to hear him. And the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. Now, what does it mean to grumble, if you grumble? Josiah?
To, complain.
Exactly, yeah. To complain or to moan or to whine, you're grumbling. Now, why might they be grumbling? Why would the Pharisees be complaining? Jonathan? Yeah, that's right. The Pharisees are grumbling and moaning because they see all these bad people, who they think are the bad people, and they see Jesus being good to them. And they think, these bad people don't deserve Jesus to be good to them. And so they grumbled and they complained. But Jesus knew what they were thinking. Jesus knew what they were saying. So he decided to answer them by telling them three parables. Now, I know you all know this. What is a parable? Nathan.
Stories that God tells people.
Mm-hmm. Stories that Jesus tells people. Jonathan?
A way to learn about him.
Yeah, exactly. A way to learn about him. Chloe? An earthly story with a heavenly meaning. A little story that Jesus made up to teach us about something very, very true. Now, he starts with the lost sheep, which is about a man who has a load of sheep and loses one, but then he goes out his way to find the sheep and bring it back and then rejoices with all of his friends and celebrates. And then he tells another story of a woman who's lost one of her coins and she looks everywhere for it and then finds it and does the same thing. She gets all her friends together and goes and celebrates. And then finally, the story of the lost son, or the prodigal son, we often hear it called. Now, verse 11 is where that starts. And Josh read it for us before. Then Jesus said, there was a man who had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of your property that will belong to me. So his father divided his property between his sons. Now, I want you to picture one of your best friends. Can you picture them? Have that person in your mind? And you at the back, if you want. Picture that person. Now, imagine when you go back to school tomorrow, or on Tuesday, because some of you have got an inset day tomorrow, look at you. Imagine when you go back to school, that friend says to you, "Hey, give me all of the birthday presents that you're going to give me for the next 10 years now." So you go home and you gather all the money together that you can. You raid all your brother and sister's piggy banks and try and get all the money you can. You plan and you think, what would that person like? And then you run out to all the shops with your mum and get a whole load of gifts. And then tomorrow in school, you go back and give them all to your friend. And as soon as your friend gets them, they stop talking to you. And they're not your friend anymore. And they disappear out of your life. Wouldn't you feel horrible? That would be a terrible thing, wouldn't it? Someone who you spent so much time with, someone who you love so much, and who you would give so much for, and you've been through so much with, would use you to get stuff and then just abandon you, betray you, like your friendship meant nothing to them. That would be horrible, wouldn't it? You'd feel heartbroken, just like the father in Jesus' story. You see, back in those days, everything that you owned would be split among your children, but only when you died. Yeah. So the son is saying to the father, he's saying, "You know what, Dad, I'd rather have all your stuff now and never see you again. Because if I stayed here, I'd only be waiting around for you to die." Does the son show love to his father? No. What does he show love for? Sam?
Money and gifts.
Money and gifts. And himself. Yeah. And does he spend it wisely and use it well? No. He doesn't even do that. He goes out and wastes it all. Now, remind me, who is Jesus speaking to in this parable? You can all say it. Pharisees and tax collectors, exactly. Now, who might the younger son of these two groups represent in this parable? The bad tax collectors or the pretty good Pharisees? Who'd you think, Eva? Yeah, the tax collectors. And who might the father represent in this story? Sam?
Jesus,
God, yeah. The younger son is the tax collectors and sinners, the bad people. When the father represents God. And you know, you may not realize it, but you and me can be just like those tax collectors. But we can be kind of self-collectors, pleasure collectors. We just live for us. You know, so often we want to live our lives enjoying God's stuff that he's made, but we don't often live our lives for the one who made them. We think that true joy is found in those things, but not in the one who gives all things. Now, you know, all the things that you love and all the things that you find really fun, God invented them. Don't know if you've thought of things like this, but God created a world where it was possible to play football. God created all the things we'd need to make ice cream and to make TVs and to make music and to make slime. All the things that you find really fun and enjoyable, God has made a world where we can do them. God didn't make the world and not realize that we could do all these fun things, and he looks down from heaven and says, "Oh no, they're having fun." That's not right. God knows what fun and pleasure is. And he created a world where we can do that. God could have created a world where it was impossible to play football or where there was no milk, so no ice cream. But he didn't. All the things that we love so much and find really fun and good and enjoyable is because God created a world where we can do those things. But so often we think that true joy and true happiness is found in those things and not in the one who gave them. And so often, we're just like that younger son. We want to enjoy all the stuff, but not really the person. And the younger son goes along like this until something happens. Verse 13. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all that he had, journeyed into a far country, and there he wasted his share of his father's property with prodigal living. Now, verse 14 says, but when he had spent everything, a severe famine. What's a famine? Eva? Exactly, where crops don't grow, there's no food. A severe famine arose in that land, and he began to be in need because he'd spent everything. And verse 15 says, so he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him into his field to feed pigs. And he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the pigs ate. Ew, that's not nice, is it? And no one gave him anything. Now, we might give all our time and all our love to stuff. But, you know, stuff runs out. Stuff breaks. And stuff becomes boring. Because God made stuff to be like that. God made stuff to run out and to break and to become boring so that, yes, we would enjoy them, but so that we wouldn't give all of our lives to enjoying those things, but rather give our lives to enjoying Him, who never runs out or never breaks or never becomes boring. See, God knew what He was doing when He created everything. But the Son has given all His life, hasn't He? He's given all his time, all his money, all his love to things. And now he's as lost as he can get. Now, there's a verse in 1 Timothy. On Wednesday evenings, we're studying through 1 Timothy, and we're going to get to this verse eventually. It's 1 Timothy 5, verse 6. And it says, she, or he, who lives for pleasure is dead while she lives. She who lives for pleasure, it's like she's dead, even though she's going around living. And if you're a person who loves and lives for sinful pleasure, then that will lead to your downfall. Either in this life, like it did with the son, or when God judges the world. It will lead to your downfall. But, verse 17, it all starts to change. But when he came to himself, when he started to think, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have enough bread and some to spare, yet I perish with hunger? And then he decides to make a plan. Verse 18, I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son, so make me like just one of your hired servants. See, the son starts to think. He stops just diving into stuff and he starts to think about what he's doing. And he realizes his own sin. And importantly, he realizes that his own sin has made his situation so bad. The only reason he's there is because of his own selfishness, isn't it? And he realizes, you know what? The things I thought were so good aren't that good. And the things I ran towards aren't as good as the father I ran away from. And he realizes what he's been chasing, what he's been seeking, what he's been going after in this far-off country isn't as good as what he left behind. Isn't as good as his father, who even made sure his servants, who were the least important people. A lot of the times, masters wouldn't really care too much about their servants, but this father makes sure that they have more than enough to eat, even them. He even cares for them. And the son also realizes he's not worthy of being a son anymore. He's been so offensive to his father that he's not even worthy of being a son. And he knows that. He realizes it. He could say, I'm not good enough for my father's house where there's joy. So, verse 20, he decides what he's going to do. And he arose and came to his father. But when he was still a long way off, his father saw him and had anger and bitterness and resentment. No, he didn't. He had compassion. He had love. And he ran to his son and fell on his neck and hugged him and kissed him and embraced him. Now, that is not what a lot of people would do in that situation. The Pharisees hearing this story would think, why is the father doing that? The father should get out a big stick and beat him because he's been sinful. But the father's not. He's running out with compassion and he's giving him grace and he's giving him mercy. And verse 21 says, the son said to him, he starts to tell him his big speech that he's prepared. The son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and sinned in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and put sandals on his feet, and bring out the fatted calf. Bring it here and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. Now, the fatted calf would be the animal that you'd have, that you'd bring out at the top, the tippity-top, best ever celebration. That would be the day when you bring out the fatted calf. You don't just bring it out for a weekend barbecue. You bring out the fatted calf when it's the best ever event. Bring out the fatted calf and kill it. Let us eat and celebrate, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. So, what makes God celebrate? Mm-hmm. Jonathan? What makes God celebrate? We can celebrate in learning about him, definitely. Josiah? Mm-hmm, yeah. A lot of your answers before were spot on. When someone's found, when someone who's dead becomes alive, when a dirty, worthless enemy of God comes back to him and God makes that person his son. That's what makes God celebrate. That's what he delights in more than anything. Now, remember the last song we sang earlier on? It's called There's a Wideness in God's Mercy. We'll put some of the words on the screen. It says, there's a wideness in God's mercy. What's mercy? What is it? Nathan?
Is it like stuff that we don't need and we really love stuff that we don't need?
It's along those lines, definitely. God giving us things that we don't deserve. And also, God not giving us the bad that we deserve. There's a wideness in God's mercy, and it's wider than the greatest sea. And so I know it covers even me, a worthless sinner who's turned away from him and loved the things more than loving him. Even me, even the younger son. There's a depth to his compassion that is deeper than I'll ever understand. And so my life is safe within his hands. You know, everyone in this room has a different relationship to me. Some people know me pretty well. Some people don't really know me very well. Some people here are my best friends. You know, God has secured for you, if you're a Christian, the best possible kind of relationship that you could ever have with him. The very best top of the chart kind of relationship that you can ever have with God ever is secured for you if you're a Christian. That's what you get. You are adopted as his son. And the younger son in the story was completely forgiven. He was put in this amazing relationship that he didn't deserve. He didn't have to work like he thought he had to earn his way back into his father's house. No. His father welcomed him back joyfully, and the younger son became justified. Now that's a big word, isn't it? At Impact, when you all go home from BBB, we're going through a series of big Bible words. Big words that we hear in Sundays and we read in the Bible, but don't always know what they mean. And this word justified was one of those words. And even if you don't know what it means yet, it's something that you need. It's something that everyone in this room needs, to be justified. So how important is it to know what it means if we all need it? Now, what does it mean, do you think? Anyone have a guess to say the younger son became justified? Now, some adults struggle with this. So if you can get it, awesome. Josiah?
To be forgiven,
definitely. Sam?
Righteous.
To be righteous, very important, yeah. Jonathan? Calm with God. Say again, my ears aren't very good. Say again.
To be with God.
To be with God, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Being justified is being declared by God to be good and declared by God to be innocent and blameless. Now, if the younger son was justified, and the younger son was declared to be good and declared to be blameless and declared to be innocent by his father, does that seem a bit strange? Why might that be a bit strange? It's a bit strange because he's not good. It's strange because he is to blame for something. And yet being justified means you're declared to be without blame. But the son has done something wrong. The son has done things against the father. He sinned. So how does that work? How can the younger son, who has done a lot of things wrong, be declared to be innocent? Well, that's exactly what the older son was thinking. Let's see what he said. Now, the older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And the servant said to him, "Your brother has come, and because your father has received him safe and sound, he's killed the fatted calf." But the older son was angry and would not go in. Therefore, his father came out and pleaded with him. So the older son answered and said to his father, "Look, these many years I have served you, and I've never disobeyed your command. Yet you never even gave me the smallest thing, like a young goat, that I might celebrate with my friends. But as soon as this son of yours came home, who is, by the way, devoured all your livelihood with harlots and sinners, you've killed the fatted calf, the best celebration gift for him." The son was not happy at all. But his father said to him, "Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was right that we should celebrate and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive again. He was lost and now is found." Remind me one last time, who is Jesus talking to in this parable? Josiah.
The Pharisees.
Mm-hmm.
And the tax collectors.
Yeah. So if the tax collectors represent the younger son, who does the older son represent? Jonathan?
The Pharisees.
The Pharisees, yeah. Exactly. The younger son represents the really sinful, and the older son represents the pretty good people. But why was the older son in the parable angry? Why was he angry? Jonathan? Exactly, yeah. Yeah, he saw the younger son getting the most, even though he didn't deserve it. The older son's thinking, if anyone deserves the good, it's me, not the younger son. So he was angry because he didn't think his brother deserved good from his father. And similarly, the Pharisees were angry because they didn't think the bad people, in their eyes, deserved good from Jesus. And the Pharisees didn't celebrate over the things that God celebrates over. But still, how does this work? How can the younger son, who's done so much wrong, be declared to be blameless? Well, if you remember the third song we sang earlier, what was it? The third song. Think of the first one, the second one, the third one. What was it? Can you remember? Luke will put it up on the screen if you can't. Go on, Jonathan.
Was it my father's house?
It was. Well done. How can the younger son be justified, be declared to be good, even though he's not? Well, we sang this. I'm not good enough for my father's house, where there's joy. But Jesus is the way to my father's house. Now, how is Jesus the way to being welcomed into my father's house? How is Jesus the way to being justified? Well, do you remember the second song we sang? It was called Rock of Ages. And in the third verse, it says this: nothing in my hand I bring, simply to your cross I cling. Naked, come to you for dress. Helpless, I look to you for grace. Now that's just what the younger son did, isn't it? He had nothing in his hands, literally, that he could offer or give to the father. And he came with nothing, and the father dressed him. He was helpless, and he had to look to his father for grace. And that's just like me and you coming to God. But that second line, simply to your cross I cling, that means the only reason that me, as a terrible sinner like the younger son, and you, as a terrible sinner like the younger son, can be welcomed back to your father's house is because what Jesus did on the cross makes it possible. The only reason I'm welcomed back is because of what Jesus did on the cross. And that's what I'm trusting in. So what has the cross got to do with being welcomed back into my father's house? Well, there's a pattern here. What was the first song we sang? Can any of you remember? Yeah, from the squalor of a borrowed stable. And the third verse says this: through the kisses of a friend's betrayal, he, that's Jesus, was lifted on a cruel cross. He was punished for the world's transgressions. Why? He was suffering to save the lost. All the sin of those who've wandered away from God was placed upon Jesus at the cross. And it was paid for. All the punishment that you and me should have was taken, if we trust in Christ, and was put on him. And because of that, me and you, who are terrible sinners, can be justified. Now, what does that word mean again? Can you remember? Justified. Nathan?
Yeah.
To become right with God by him declaring you to be blameless, even though you are to blame for something. Now, some Christians like to explain being justified like this. Being justified is God seeing me just as if I'd never sinned. So God forgives me and saves me, and then he sees me just as though I'd never sinned at all. But that's not true, because it's so much better than that. You see, when God looks at you as a Christian, he doesn't see someone who's never, ever sinned. He sees a terrible sinner, but a terrible sinner who's been covered by Jesus' goodness that has been swapped to you. You see, when someone like you or me, a sinner, someone like the younger son, comes back to God and trusts in Jesus, then the most incredible thing happens. There's a swap that Jesus does. All of our judgment that we deserve for our sin is swapped to Jesus. And all of Jesus' goodness is swapped to me. So when God looks at me, what does he see? Not my judgment, not my sin, but he sees the goodness of Jesus that has been swapped to me. That's what becoming a Christian is. Now, let me explain it like this. What's this? Jonathan. It's kind of a picture frame. What do you think this is?
A blackboard.
A blackboard, yeah. Don't know if you're allowed to say that word these days, but hey, yeah. It's a blackboard. Now, what do you do on a blackboard? Jonathan? Well, maybe not a crayon, but what's this called? Scarlet? Chalk, exactly. If your life was a blackboard and chalk is sin, and all our lives are covered and completely messed up with sin, becoming a Christian isn't God wiping your slate clean. Becoming a Christian is God taking that away and giving you Jesus' slate that can never become dirty again. Isn't that so much better? You're completely covered with Jesus' goodness. Or another way of explaining it, what game is this? Hannah. Monopoly. Now, here's a Monopoly board. And Sam, there's a card for you. Now, who should we be? Let's be the battleship. So, here's your Monopoly board. You start at Go. Now, where do you not want to end up in Monopoly? Sophia?
The police.
Yeah, the police. Go to jail. You don't want to be there. So, if you're going around and you land yourself in jail, that's not a good thing, is it? Now, if your life was a game of Monopoly, and sin is what lands you in jail... Oh, I've dropped my ship. If sin is what lands you in jail, then Sam, what does your card say?
Get out of jail free.
Get out of jail free. Being a Christian, becoming a Christian, is not like getting a get out of jail free card. Being a Christian, becoming a Christian, is being taken out of jail, being taken right to the end of the game, being given all the money in the bank, and being given all of the property. It's all yours. That's why God celebrates. Because he's given you everything. It's not just taking you out of jail and putting you back to square one, just as if you'd never landed in jail. It's better than that. He's taken you right to the end for you. He's given you all that you can ever have. He's given you all of the things that you can have. That's what God does when you or I become a Christian. He takes sinners, enemies of him, and he doesn't just view them as if they'd never sinned in the first place. No, he sees the sin. He remembers the sin, but it's so much more amazing because they're covered by Jesus' goodness. The Father doesn't say to the Son, I'm going to view you just as if you'd always been alive. It's more amazing than that. He says, my Son was dead. He was lost, but now he's alive. Now he's forgiven. And how much more amazing is it to be a wretch who's been redeemed than having never been a wretch in the first place? And so the Father says in verse 32, it was right that we should celebrate and be glad. Why? Because your brother was dead. It really happened. And he is alive again. He was lost. And now he's found. See, that was the point that Jesus makes in his first two parables, that God celebrates over things like this. In verse 7, he said, I say to you likewise that there will be joy in heaven over one sinner who repents. And in verse 10, he said, likewise, I tell you, there's joy in the presence of the angels of God when a sinner repents. This is what makes God so happy. When a sinner says, I'm not good enough for my Father's house, but I know Jesus is the way. When a sinner says, nothing in my hands I bring, but simply to the cross I cling, that's when God celebrates. And Jesus' point to the Pharisees is this: God's compassion, God's love, is so great that it even reaches and includes the bad people. And that makes God celebrate. And because it makes God celebrate, it should make us celebrate, not be grumbly. And his point to the tax collectors was that God can forgive anyone. And he does save and forgive people. So we should celebrate and not grumble. Now, one final thought. There's a person who some of us here know very well. He's one of my best friends. And his name is Chris Hughes. Now, Chris Hughes is 1 month older than me. And at the moment, he's with his wife and his son in Papua New Guinea, telling people who've never heard about Jesus before all about this, that God has compassion on the worst of sinners. Now, I want you to look around the room and look at the faces of the people behind you. Go on, you can stand up and have a look around the room. Go on. Stand up and look at the people's faces behind you. Go on. What are their faces like? Some happy, some grumpy, eh? Well, do you know what I liked most about Chris Hughes? We were often at YL, and there'd be someone giving a talk, like there is at BBB or Impact or something like that, and they would be talking from the Bible, saying something amazing about God, and you'd look around the room, and you'd see the usual faces. Like this. You'd see the person next to them. You'd see the person next to them. And then you'd see Chris Hughes with a massive smile. Why? Because he rejoiced at the things he was hearing. Every single time there was a talk, you could look around the room and see all the grumbling faces. But then you'd see Chris Hughes, who would smile every time. Why? Because he realized that he was just like the younger son in real life. He realized how much he'd been forgiven, and he realized how much he'd been given. And that made him rejoice. He realized the things that made God celebrate. And then he celebrated. Now, if God celebrates that we've been saved, how much more should we be doing the celebrating? Now, Chris Hughes, his heart of celebration has caused him to go and has caused him to tell people about Jesus. And that heart is a gift from God. Now, if your children, not your children, you don't have any, if your children or your grandchildren never see you happy or celebrating at the thought of everything that God has done, or see you more happy or more celebratory at other things, then what does that tell them about the value of the gospel? Do they think, oh, Daddy doesn't really get excited when he hears about Jesus. Daddy gets excited when he watches football. So therefore, Jesus must be not as worthwhile as football. Or, oh, Mummy gets really passionate when she watches Strictly, but she doesn't really get passionate when she reads the Bible. Therefore, it must be that entertainment is more important and valuable than reading the Creator's book. Or, Granny and Grandad don't really look very happy when they sing the hymns. I don't really understand all the words, but I know that they do. So therefore, what they're singing about mustn't be that great. Everything you do, or everything you don't do, makes an impression. Do you celebrate over the things that God celebrates in? Do you hear these things, sing those hymns, and does your heart rejoice because of everything God has done for you? So, in closing, the Pharisees were like who? The older son or the younger son? The Pharisees, Nathan? The older son. They weren't happy because they thought these bad people don't deserve good from Jesus. And they didn't celebrate over the things that God celebrates over. And the tax collectors were like the younger son. They were the bad people who had been gladly welcomed by Jesus. And they realized that and they did celebrate over it. Now our final hymn has these words. In royal robes, I don't deserve. See, everyone in this room is either wearing the filth of sin or they're wearing the robe of Jesus' goodness. Back in the parable when the father took the son's dirty, sinful clothes, his dirty clothes, and gave him the best robe and the ring and the sandals. That's like a picture of God dealing with our sin and giving us the righteousness of Jesus. So, which one are you wearing? Are you either wearing the filth of your own sin still, or have you been covered by the robe of Jesus' goodness? You know, it makes God so joyful to take off the filth of our sin and to lay it on Jesus, who pays for it and destroys it, and then give us the royal robes that we don't deserve. There's nothing that God celebrates over more. That God can take sinners who've made themselves dirty and made themselves shameful and worthless and made themselves enemies And God takes those people and turns them into sons who are clean and forgiven and justified. And that is what makes God celebrate. So let's stand and sing this last hymn. King of Kings, Majesty.